You are listening to another Screenfish One-on-One, this time live with director Nadine Pakaneza. Set against the waters of the North Atlantic, the new documentary Last of the Right Whales shines a light on the rapidly decreasing numbers of this lovely species. As their migration routes alter from the coast of Florida to the Gulf of St. Lawrence, the film looks to the safety issues that the right whale faces on a daily basis and what our role may be in helping rebuild the population. In this one-on-one, we speak to Pakaneza about the challenges in getting such incredible footage, the response she's gotten from people in the fishing industry, and how these experiences have changed her. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate you reaching out.
Well, it's a beautiful film, and it's sad, and it's wonderful, and it's harrowing, and it's magical. I mean, there's all sorts of emotions sort of brought into this story. I was wondering how you got involved in it and why you're so passionate about Last of the Right Whales.
Yeah, well, the emotional journey you just described is exactly what I experienced making the film. And I became involved when there were so many reports back in 2017 of whales dying. In the space of a few months, 17 North Atlantic right whales died. And originally the headlines were reporting that they didn't know why, because the necropsies had not yet been performed. But it became evident pretty soon, or pretty early on, that the causes were, you know, ship strike and entanglement. And this was, I had no idea this was happening in the oceans. You know, living in Toronto, we're so disconnected from nature in general, but from the marine world even more so. And so when I learned that these deaths were preventable, and I assume that most people were probably in the same situation as me, not knowing much about right whales, if they'd even heard of them, and certainly not knowing about the threat and the potential extinction that they're facing within the next 20 years.
At the end of the film, you talk about how there's been an increase in the last, I think it was 2020, those numbers were for 2020.
2021, so it was the last season, the last calving season, there were 18 born. And, you know, while we were filming in 2018, there was zero.
Yeah.
And so, but even that 18 is about half of what the projection is when the whales are reproducing as expected or at capacity, you know. And so what they're finding is that the reproductive rates are lower. Mm. So the span in between calving, it used to be between 3 to 4 years. Now it's as many as 9 years before a female will have another calf. And also the calving, the age of calving has been delayed. So while they reach sexual maturity at 9, many of them are not having calves until they're 15 or older. So it's there's a number of reasons for that, which the documentary gets into, but a lot of it has to do with the stressors and then the availability of food, which has been worsened by climate change.
That was one of the things I was interested in, is the film does talk about the dramatic shifts in the food. But it still seems unclear as to what those reasons are. I mean, climate change, sure. But I was wondering if there have been anything that you're aware of since the completion of the footage that has given any clarity to what has been happening there. What is it about, or why are these right whales ending up in these random locations?
It is really search for food. And the shift has happened very quickly. So in 2010, I mean, they've been going quite regularly to the Gulf of Maine, the Roseway Basin, which is just south of Nova Scotia, and the Bay of Fundy to feed. And then all of a sudden in 2010, they sort of disappeared. And it took scientists a while to catch up with them, and probably some time for the whales to find a location where there was enough density of the food that they're searching for. But it was in 2015 that scientists found them in large numbers in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And since then, they've been studying their use of this new habitat every year. And they're moving around. I mean, the Gulf of St. Lawrence is very large. And so they're moving around and using the habitat differently each year. And the scientists are trying to pinpoint where those concentrations of calanus, which is the type of prey they seek, It's a type of copepod. It's a tiny crustacean. It's about the size of a grain of rice. And the reason the distribution of this is changing, it's within plankton, but it's brought down from currents from the Arctic. And with global warming, the warm current that's coming up from the south is actually cutting off this current from the north. And so the supply route for this colonist to come south into the Gulf of Maine and into the Bay of Fundy has been cut off by this warm current coming up from the south. And so that's why the colonist is being redistributed. Mm. And you'll hear Kim Davies in the film, Dr. Kimberly Davies, that's been studying the colonists in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, talk about a regime shift. And that's what oceanographers call it when something like this happens very quickly. And they've actually never seen anything like it before. And so it can dramatically affect organisms along the entire food network.
For sure.
I should say food web. Sorry, Steve. Yeah.
No, totally. That's great. It's amazing the domino effects these things have. And one of the things else that I really appreciated about the film is that historically, when we look at films about the environment, we look at films about species that are on the endangered list, the villains are the cruel fishermen or the mean old boaters that just won't share. But, I mean, there's a couple of things here. First of all, it's amazing. There are so many people that you interview that are just genuinely moved by the experience of seeing these animals. Fishermen just actually saddened and in tears with the passing of one of the young ones. I was wondering if you were surprised by the response of the people who were involved in the industry.
There's definitely that, what you described first, the general reaction, or at least how fishers are portrayed generally when you talk about subjects of conservation, is exactly what you described. And so I really wanted in the film to show that there are fishers out there, both recreational and commercial, who are very concerned about the environment and conservation. And we find this now with, you know, the one fisher that's in the film, Mark Noel, who I believe you're speaking about, and then also the recreational fisher that was down in the Gulf of Mexico. They're conservationists at heart, you know, because they live on the sea. They make their living from the sea, or they spend a lot of their time out there if it's recreational for them. But they have a better understanding than most of us who live in landlocked cities or communities about what's happening in the ocean. And so I think there is sensitivity to what's going on with these whales. And, you know, certainly with Martin, he's made a concerted effort to try and learn more since they've moved into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, which is where he and his family have been fishing for three generations, you know, and he recognizes that in order to continue that livelihood, which supports many communities in Canada on the East Coast, he'll need to understand what's going on with the whales and how they're being impacted by climate change and what it means for the fishery and how they can adapt in order to make space for both the whales and the fishers. And so I wasn't surprised. More so, I really wanted people to see this other perspective and attitude from people who work in those industries, because it's out there. I mean, Martin's not alone. You know, he and other fishers from his hometown in Shipigan, they've created the first disentanglement team in that region. And so they're actually going out volunteering to disentangle whales when they are found in the Gulf of St. Lawrence.
It was interesting. Like, you talk about at one point, somebody... forgive me, I can't remember who it was, but somebody says that the true villain is rope, which is not something I've heard before. But there's also these other opportunities. You talk about the new opportunities. What have you found the response to be from the fishermen in regards to these new opportunities? Because it's got to affect them differently, higher costs, the big greater challenges. And I know that there's some of that within the film, but like you said, there many of them seem to be conservationists on their own. But what has been the feeling about taking these new opportunities?
Yeah, it's been approached with some trepidation. You know, we're talking about people at this, largely we're talking about fixed gear fisheries. So that's lobster, snow crab. And by fixed gear, I mean lines that stay in the water. So attached to a trap at the bottom of the ocean and a buoy at the surface. And that's what really is a risk for the whales, because they can swim into it and get rolled up in it and not be able to get free. And then actually, you know, it can cause lethal injuries. And so 85% of that population, the right whale population in the North Atlantic, has been entangled at one point in their life, if not more. So back to your question, though, you have to understand that these industries have been fishing that way for hundreds of years.
Sure.
Right. And so this adaptation, it's significant. And for when it was first suggested to them after all the mortalities in 2017, they started testing in 2018. But at first suggestion, most of them just couldn't believe it would be possible that you could fish without having that trap line, because that's how they find their trap. That's how they retrieve the catch. But they were willing to try, you know, and so they have been testing for the past 3 or 4 years, and every year more fishermen are willing to test and try. And I think it will depend on the fishery, the regulations associated with that fishery, and the sea conditions, because all of these things impact how viable it is to fish like this on a commercial level. But there have been, they call it a pop-up system, the gear that's shown in the film. They've been using that system in Australia since 2012 commercially in the lobster fishery. So how it can be adapted for the North Atlantic and for the fisheries here is something that fishers are testing both in the United States and Canada. And so you're right. It's a massive change for them. It's very expensive, the new gear. And so government has stepped in, at least in Canada, to help support that transition. And the more consumers know about what's happening out there and the solutions that are available, the more support that they can give for government to support fishers and changes to the way that they operate to make it safer for the whales. I think it will move along, you know, but it's a process.
Sure, it'd be a huge change for them. I wanted to ask too, because the footage in there in this is, it's beautiful. There's some just beautiful footage, especially of the whales themselves. Now, I know that you needed to get permission in order to get closer. I was wondering, was it difficult to do that? Was it difficult to get such footage for you?
It was incredibly difficult.
Fair.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, there, scientists estimate there's about 360 of these whales left in the world.
Yeah.
And so trying to find that few number of whales in a massive ocean, you know, they range is from Florida all the way to the Gulf of St. Lawrence, about 1,600 kilometers. So you can imagine they're not necessarily easy to find, first of all.
Sure.
And then when you do find them, how much time are they spending at the surface? Because we're not allowed to dive with them. Because of their critically endangered status, you can't get within 100 meters in Canada or 500 yards unless you have a federal permit. So that was our first step, to try and have the ability to work under these federal permits to get close enough to try and use drones to get the imagery that you see in the film. And it was, you know, it was quite nerve-wracking at times. You would be out there for days looking for whales, especially the mom calves, because there's so few being born. And so when we were filming in the calving area, we were down there for 2 seasons in order to get the footage that you see in the film. But when you do get it, it's quite spectacular. I mean, yeah. The moms and calves, they're so tactile. They're really in contact you know, physical contact almost all the time. And it's so playful. The way they interact, I found it really beautiful. I could watch it for hours.
Well, that leads perfectly into, and starting to wrap up with our time here, but leads perfectly into my last question, which is, you hear so many stories of people whose lives have been changed after an encounter with sea life. And I was just wondering how this experience has affected and maybe even changed you.
Yeah, well, it was incredible. I mean, you're talking about animals that have been on the earth for millions of years. And so I think it's the closest you can come to seeing a dinosaur, if I could make that comparison. They really do have a prehistoric sense about them, in the way they look, in the way they sound, just their breathing when they come to the surface. It's incredible. And so it really helps put in perspective our place in the ecosystem. And it makes you feel a part of that when you see the impact that we can have on other animals, especially when you're talking about great whales. You know, there's so few of them left. And right now there's more right whales being killed than since whaling. You know, that's what we've returned to. And so having these encounters really makes you think about that, think about the impact that humans are having on the world and how we have to start thinking about our place here as a reciprocal relationship with nature. I found myself thinking a lot about that. And I think, honestly, during the pandemic, a lot of people have been thinking about these deeper things, more introspective, more time to think about what we're doing here and what responsibilities we have to the world around us.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, it's interesting. You hear these stories in the pandemic of the world being so much quieter, that nature having a chance to come alive again. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not suggesting that this is necessarily one of those stories, but certainly certainly a moment of pause for us to reflect on the things that, how we need to care for our environment so much more fully.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot about slowing down. You know, the vessel strikes are boats moving too fast in the ocean, ships, because we're talking about anything from containers to these small recreational fishing boats that are only maybe 40 feet long. So, and maybe taking a little extra time to fish with gear that may not be as efficient, but certainly can have a huge positive impact on the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. Nadine, thank you so much for chatting with me. I really do appreciate it. It's a beautiful film with some beautiful footage and asked some wonderful questions. So it's premiering this weekend at the Calgary International Film Festival. Is that correct?
That's right. Sunday, September 26th, 7 p.m. I'm leaving to go out there just after this call.
Excellent. All right. Well, I wish you the best with it. And thank you so much for taking the time for chatting with me. So I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Take care. Thanks so much.